and unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. Beautiful spring day. If you have trouble hearing me in the back, I was listening to one of my audios the other day. We have a website up now, OccidentalLagunaSangha.org. There's an old one, net, but sometimes it's Google hasn't quite caught up. But that site's off. So you can log on to that, and the audios of the preceding talks on the Heart Sutra are there, so you can get caught up if you'd like. There's also a reading list, kind of beginning and advanced, and then also the yearly calendar. So we take a quantum leap in organizational ability here. And so take a look at it. We have a little logo and everything. So I think it's kind of nice. A little bit still. And there'll be pictures. What I'd like is to have, we have a bunch of pictures of when we do retreats and things, and what I'd like is every time we log on, like a new array of pictures will come up. I just have to figure out how to honor. Some people don't like to have their pictures, so I have to figure out how that happens. We get just people who get permission to put their pictures on. So in an announcement, there will be, you know, we have two retreats a year at St. Dorothy's, and I sent out an announcement the other day about that. That'll be Friday, the 30th, I think, of April, or is it the 31st?
April.
The 30th, right?
Of April.
April. And then Saturday, and then we'll end on Sunday. And, you know, it's a, those of you that have sat before, it's a beautiful experience. It gives us a chance to experience a little bit what monastic practice is like, just for a few days. And even though it's just a short period of time, and I mean this in a good way, it seems much longer, actually, than just, a two-day retreat. So there's a sign-up sheet out there. A couple of other things. On the 11th, Susan's going to do her workshop on Jizo, where we're going to give a little talk on Jizo, and then people can repair to her studio to make their own little Jizo, the Bodhisattva protection. And then Peggy's going to have an event at her house on the 18th. She has an altar. She's going to do kind of an opening for her altar. So I thought maybe we'd let's open to the first page and let's chant the Heart Sutra together. This is my translation. We've been using the more traditional translation. Great wisdom, beyond wisdom, Heart Sutra. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara,
the embodiment of enlightened compassion, when practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, the wisdom that goes beyond wisdom, perceive that we are all empty of the separate self, empty of permanent characteristics and independent of all things. Know then that all material forms are empty of the slightest substantial self-existence, and that luminous emptiness does not differ from material forms. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness form. The same is true of conscious states, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. All are empty of independent self-existence. Also know that all structures of relativity are empty of inherent self-existence. Free from characteristic marks or limits, they do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. Therefore, no emptiness, no independent form, feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, object of mind, no independent realm of eyes until no realm of mind consciousness. No ignorance and also no extinction of it, until no old age and death, and also no extinction of it. No suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no cognition, also no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva, a great being, depends on prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on prajnaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know the prajnaparamita is the great transcendent mantra, is the great bright mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the prajnaparamita mantra. Proclaim the mantra that says, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasangate, Bodhisattva. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone far beyond, pure presence ever transcending. It is total awakeness, it is suchness.
So, how, you know, how does the Heart Sutra, how can the Heart Sutra help us in our practice? Well, it encourages us to really trust that being present is the healing salve for our afflictions. That if we can abide, if we can begin to entertain the possibility and lead our lives more from the perspective of how reality really is, that it will help us in our fear and suffering. That things, in fact, are not fixed. They are not weighty. They are not permanent. They are not independent. And they are not separate. As much as our deeply ingrained habits of thinking actually believe the exact opposite of that. That's actually not how things really are. They are not the way we normally see things. So the Heart Sutra is a pretty radical invitation to see things a different way. And that as we were studying here, all dharmas, as we go through Heart Sutra, all dharmas do not appear or disappear. There is no distinction in the sentence between conditioned dharmas and unconditioned, meaning that there are a pretty radical statement here that there's not a difference between this world of samsara and the world of nirvana, that they're inextricably intertwined, that nirvana is not found beyond this very world that we in fact live in. And that whatever we conceptually project, is by its nature wrong. Because whatever we conceptually project is fixed and permanent. And that is not the way things are. So the reason the Heart Sutra is so radical is that it undermines all views. All views are provisional. We can use them, and they're important, but at an absolute level, they're just provisional. I went to see a movie the other night. I don't necessarily recommend it because it it's pretty you know, it's hard to go to sleep. The Green Zone. I don't know if you've seen it, but my wife is, because her father suffered from post-traumatic stress as a World War II heavy-duty combat veteran, and the Battle of the Bulge and a number of other things, and she grew up with that. So she's working with this through Zen Center, trying to bring mindfulness-based stress reduction to working with returned veterans. So we've been actually going to see some of these movies like The Hurt Locker and The Green Zone, which gives you a pretty good feeling of how people get post-traumatic stress. But what I came away from the movie was that Here we go in with how we normally think. We're the good guys. This is what's happening. This is the way it is. And the guy is very straightforward, and he's very on focus, and this is what's going to happen. And then as the movie unfolds, we begin to see that the good guys, us, aren't actually necessarily the good guys. That some of the bad guys are not necessarily the bad guys. What we think is true is in fact not true. Mm-hmm. And the world is topsy-turvy. And I think if... you know, if she had had the Heart Sutra, it would have helped a little bit. You know, would have helped. So, from the sentence where it says, also know that all structures are relatively or empty of inherent self-existence, free from characteristic marks or limits. They do not appear or disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase or decrease. This is the being. This says what the Heart Sutra wants to say. And then everything after that is basically reinforcing that premise. And the way that that is done, and it's, I think, rather extremely radical and rather beautiful. It would be like if a Christian was to take the Bible, or a Muslim was to take the Quran and say, "This is, there's some really beautiful teachings in here, but they only go so far. Please don't base your entire reality on the basis of this book. It's provisional. Take it with a certain lightness." And this really is what the Heart Sutra is saying about. It takes, now it begins to say, okay, let's apply this. Let's look at this to all the things that Buddhism holds most sacred as its most sacred teaching. Let's go through the three or four things that Buddhism says is absolutely the sine qua non of Buddhist teaching, and let's see that these are all provisional, that you cannot hang on to these. What an amazing kind of religion that can do that, that can actually look at the very things it holds most sacred. So the first thing it does, it says, therefore, no. In emptiness, there is no independent form, feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, object of mind. No independent realm of eyes until no realm of mind consciousness. So what it's doing here is basically saying the same thing that it said up here. Under the first paragraph, perceived that all skandhas are empty, or that we are all empty of the separate self. That the way Buddhism constructs the way the world comes into existence is that an eye makes contact with an object and a sense results. An eye, an ear, a nose, a tongue, rupa, the body, and then consciousness. The six realms of these sense states make contact, and then out of that results a formation. Sight, sound, smell. This is how the world is formulated. And what's important about this in terms of, I mean, these early teachings are very important, because one thing it says is that the world that we see it is not created independently from our realm of consciousness. The world is not separate from how we perceive it. So how we construct the world, how we think and our consciousness about the world is not separate from the world itself. This is different from the way the West often looks at things, or the way we usually look at things. That's reality, how I perceive it, and there's not, that's more, maybe more real than how I perceive it, rather than how I perceive it is what makes it real. Or they're completely intertwined. You take much more of a sense of responsibility when you really see it from this Buddhist perspective. So these are the what they call the 18 dhatus. You take the six sense realms, the objects, and the result, they add up to 18 dhatus. So this no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. Basically, it's just another way of saying that the skandhas And this is directly applying to what Shariputra believes. Remember in the other translation, Shariputra is the one that says, you don't exist as a separate human being. You're basically just these 18 dhatus in formation. But the Heart Sutra begins to see there's a limitation to this. That even this is not taking it far enough. And the Heart Sutra is, and this is very radical at this particular time, around the second century. He's saying, even these have no fundamental reality. Even these are not fixed. You cannot hang on to even these things, which you think are the constituent formations which basically break down your idea of what a solid sense of self is. Even these, just like if we were to look at atoms or molecules through the eye of quantum physics, we'd see that eventually it just dissolves into energy. This is really what they're saying in the second century. You cannot find it. You can't find anything. So it's taking this very sacred doctrine and it's beginning to kind of peel away the way things normally, how things are. So you have to let go of this very sacred thing that you think of in Buddhist theology. Then the second thing it begins to look at is the nature of causality. So what the original Buddhist said was, the next sentence, it says, actually I'm going to go over, because I've translated, it's easier to go over to the second page, it says, okay, therefore given emptiness, no form, no sensations, no perceptions, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. So of course there are these things, but what I just said, you can't really find them. They're all completely mixed up with one another. Then it goes on and it says, no realm of mind consciousness. So then it says, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance. So that sentence, what that is saying is, that's taking the Buddhist doctrine of dependent co-origination, dependent origination, which is one of the most sacrosanct premises of Buddhism. It's the one that when Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, it's how he actually came to enlightenment, was to by penetrating deeply this idea of dependent co-origination, which is a lot like emptiness, actually. It's basically seen that all causes and conditions are the result of other causes and conditions, which is, emptiness does not deny that. And you're familiar with it, the way it's presented. We've done this before, show and tell, is by the wheel, which you've all seen. You're all familiar with the wheel. They abbreviate it. They don't give you all 12. They just say ignorance and extinction of it. They jump from the first, which is ignorance, here, to death, which is number 12 here. So if you went around, you know, on the inside of the different heaven and hell realms, greed, hate, and delusion, which turns the whole thing, Buddha, which is, who's Buddha on here? Buddha over here, overseeing the whole thing with a sense of understanding from Prajnaparamita, although this is usually not, this is was constructed before the Prajnaparamita came in. But it also represents the totality of oneness. So one way to look at this is you have the undifferentiated whole. You have the way things really are. Completely whole, completely present in oneness. And then you have ignorance, number one. Ignorance begins to come in and it begins to say, let's begin to differentiate. Let's begin to separate things out. Let's take the Garden of Eden and let's take a bite of the apple, right? And then you start to move into the second formation, which is certain karmic influences come into play. And then consciousness begins to come into play. And then the fourth is name and form. Nama-rupa comes into form. Things begin to solidify. The fifth, you actually begin to have the skandhas come into play. Eyes, ears, nose, perception. These things come into play. And then 6 through 10 are the result of what happens when you start to perceive the universe. You begin to perceive something. You begin to have a conditioned response to it. You have a feeling, oh, I really like that. I really don't like that. And then you create your own sense of heaven and hell. You begin to become more attached to either having something or not having something. Things begin to solidify more and more in a solidified manner, which is what the Heart Sutra is telling you to be careful about. Birth happens in number 11. Death happens in number 12. And the cycle begins all over again. How do you get off this cycle? So the Heart Sutra is saying, provisionally, this is good. And you need to think of this sort of poetic, you know, not, you don't have to take this quite so literally.
Right.
But it gives you an idea about how we keep on the wheel. And what the Heart Sutra is saying, well, it's as good as far as it goes, but you can't really divide these things. These things that you're dividing into these 12 categories, even these things aren't fixed. You can't. They're so intertwined that you have to even, don't take refuge in just this doctrine of dependent origination. It's helpful, but you need to go beyond this. You need to go into feeling more the sense of the flow. That in fact the world is really a dynamic, fluid creation. It's not static in any way. Matter is not different from consciousness. No hard and fast distinctions. And then the next doctrine that the Heart Sutra takes under consideration is the next phrase where it says there's neither ignorance nor extinction of itness, neither old age or death. And Thich Nhat Hanh, by the way, has a really nice chapter on a very specific level, how he deals, how if we, as I was mentioning last week about the wave and the ocean, you know, how we can look more deeply into all things and we see that, in fact, we existed before we came in, even before we were in our mother's womb, we existed, and that we will exist in some form after we die. And if we can begin to reflect and contemplate and see that in all of nature, the sense of impermanence and non-fixed state, it can help us in the sense of how we hold our own transiency. Then it says here, no suffering, you see that sentence? No suffering, no cause, no sensation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. See that? What that is, it's referring to the foundation of Buddhist teaching, the Four Noble Truths. And saying, no, even these, the very basis of Buddhist doctrine, even these are held in the realm of emptiness. So, those of you remember that the Four Noble Truths are that there is suffering. And initially, the way that was viewed was that there was old age, there was death, there was sickness, the very real things that we all confront in our lives all the time. There's suffering. And how do we begin to hold the suffering? And how do we get out of just the realm of suffering? And as the Heart Sutra, more and more people begin to develop this idea of suffering, they begin to see it really as that when one side of what the doctrine of emptiness is that it's a little disconcerting, right? Right? When we actually begin to see that everything is completely impermanent, that there is nothing graspable, there is nothing that we can hold on to. This is the very basis of existential anxiety, which I studied a little bit of, you know, existential psychology, that we all carry this existential anxiety. This is what you're talking about in terms of suffering. That we know that we're impermanent. We know that there's a part of us that knows this. And it creates a lot of fear that we have. And what the Buddha was saying is, and that the cause of this fear is, and initially it was, suffering is caused because of sensual desire. If you just weren't attached to the sensual things of the material world, that would eliminate your suffering. You would be detached from the sensual, you're wanting to seek refuge in material forms. But then as Buddhism began to evolve, using the doctrine of emptiness, working with this existential anxiety, was that really what the heart of it was this not wanting to see and abide the truth of reality. That things are ungraspable, that nothing is fixed, and that everything is impermanent. That's the reason. We want things to be permanent. We want things to be predictable. We want things to be fixed, and we want things to be solid because it gives us a sense of security. But that is not the way things are. How do you get off this wheel? Well, the way you get off the wheel is by understanding the reality of how things really are and really practicing it. And so even the original, you know, there's various ways you can break that down. Practicing morality, taking care of other people, seeing the connection, using meditation to understand deeply the fluidity of your thoughts in your body, and understanding, having deep insight into impermanence. Or you can use the Eightfold Path that Buddha originally set forth, which was, and were the seeds of the practice of emptiness really were. Please have deep understanding and deep view about the nature of reality, that things aren't fixed. And we're seeing it quite as developed as the Heart Sutra was, but they were saying right understanding, right view, and then because you have right view and right understanding, of course you're going to speak appropriately and skillfully and with kindness. Of course you're going to get how you live your life is going to be this way. You're going to have right effort. You're going to have right livelihood. You're not going to be engaged in livelihood that's going to harm other people. Right? And then you will have right concentration, and you will have right mindfulness. And right mindfulness and right concentration are going to take you right back again into right view and right understanding, and then you're going to lead your life with integrity. And so the Eightfold Path is a template for how to lead your life. But here we are in the Heart Sutra, it's saying this is all very good. Please don't stop doing these things. We encourage it, but don't get stuck on it. Don't tack it on the wall and think it's like the Ten Commandments and that you're going to defend it with your life. It's just another point of view that can be helpful. But it's also this whole thing, going back to in the second paragraph where it's saying nothing tainted and nothing pure. Remember that all right views also come out of wrong views, right? You can't have. It's moving you to a place of where you're not, again and again, you're not putting anything out of the circle. You're not putting anything out of the circle. So on a practical level, you know, how do we apply to this point? How do we apply the Heart Sutra? Well, as I said at the beginning of our meditation, it will help us stay a little more present, to trust a little more that just being as present as we can will help us. Just stay with what's actually happening in this moment. Not having concepts about the way they ought to be or should be. What are they right now, and how can we work with them skillfully in this minute? We become more flexible, more malleable. We become more accepting. We understand that other people have views. We understand that we have views. But you know, we have a little more of a sense of humor about the whole process. You know, we're not willing to quite go to the mat all the time. Or we begin to look, when we begin to see ourselves contract so strongly around other people's points of views or our own, we begin to lighten up and see, wait a minute, there's a little more open, flexible, fluid way to look at this whole thing. And most importantly, we see that all things are interconnected. We treat things with kindness and respect and with compassion. So out of the Heart Sutra comes the Bodhisattva ideal of how we deal with one another. Can you actually practice the Heart Sutra? Can you actually hold your life with this kind of open awareness, where everything is actually at one level okay? Everything is actually okay because it is what it is, and it's just in flow, and everything is related to one another. Can you actually do that? Can you hold your life like, well, of course there's birth and death? Well, as Norman Fisher says, and I agree, yes and no. That we're human beings, we're conditioned. When we get a diagnosis, fear arises. When our loved ones get sick, when we see pain in the world, we respond. So on one level, we do, we feel. We contract around our conditioned reality. But the Heart Sutra can also simultaneously help us, right? It can give us a perspective of actually the okayness of all things, that in the big picture, and it can give us a tremendous sense of peace. You know, when you see these New Yorker cartoons of the guru on top of the mountaintop, you know, and people are always climbing up and asking a question, you know, it's sort of this archetypal thing, you know. Well, there is that about where does the spiritual person abide in a place of peace amidst the turmoil of the world. So there is that place. We have the capacity to do that. And if we can come and cultivate that capacity sometimes in our life, then it will inform the rest of our life. So I like the part where then it goes in, it says here, so there's no ignorance, no old age and death, no extinction. No suffering. So it says no suffering, no cause of suffering, no sensation, no past. So the four noble truths. And therefore it says, and we can even just give up even knowing about that. And then it says here, no attainment. So that's pretty radical. No attainment, right? So what it's saying is, there's no thing out there that is heaven. This is not where it's at. There's some solid object out there called heaven that you're going to get to. There's something called nirvana that you're going to get to, that's fixed and that's going to take care of you for the rest of your life. There is no place like that, because there's no fixed place, right? So how can we say that's going to be a fixed place? There's no fixed place. So you have to kind of give up that. It doesn't mean that you don't have some experiences of peace. You don't have some experiences of what nirvana is like, or the extinction of your hindrances is like. It just means don't hang on to it. You know, so when people go to Suzuki Roshi and they say, I've had this amazing enlightening experience, the Satori experience, you know, in my meditation, And he is saying, this is fantastic, really hang on to this, please don't regress back to your old state. You know, he would say more, don't worry, it'll pass. Which is really coming right from the Heart Sutra, right? And is so much more compassionate, because that's really what happens, you know? With nothing to attain. With nothing to attain, you don't have to. Isn't it great? You don't have to prove yourself anymore. You can just relax. That's what I tell everybody in therapy, right? You're okay the way you are. Well, but I'm not okay the way I am. Or Sukriya says, well, you're perfect the way you are, but you could use a little work, right? The Heart Sutra is true, but it's okay. You can go out and work for social justice. So, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. How can there be any hindrance when you just let it go, when you're in the flow, or in the Tao? Without any hindrance, there is no fear. So this is kind of beautiful, right? Through this whole thing, this is actually a pretty heavy dialectic, you know, between emptiness and no emptiness, and then he just gets right down here and he says, look, basically it's about letting go and it's about fear, because that's the heart of it. That's the heart of it all, is fear. We're always working with our fear. Far beyond all, it used to say, our other translation says perverted views. This is a better translation. It says inverted, meaning that the way we usually see things, you know, fixed, solid, permanent, conceptual, this point of view is right. We're going to turn that around. We're going to invert it to the way it really ought to be. So we're going to change this around. And one realizes nirvana. But not the kind of nirvana that we thought, which is fixed and permanent. It means the more you can abide in this way of looking, the more you can rely on prajnaparamita and the power of pure presence, the more your fear will decrease. And just, you know, talk to anybody that deals with anxiety states. Please try to stay in the present moment as much as possible. Not worry too much about the future, or, you know, have too much remorse about the past. It will help your anxiety. All Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on prajnaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Therefore know the prajnaparamita is the great miraculous mantra, the great bright mantra, the supreme mantra, the incomparable mantra which moves all suffering, is true, not false. There proclaim the prajnaparamita mantra, the mantra that says, gate gate, paragate parasamgati bodhisvaha. So at the end, it just folds into a mantra, which is the way most people practice this. You probably know more about the Heart Sutra than most people that have been chanting it their whole lives in Asia, in terms of the kind of philosophical underpinnings of what this all has to say. What's most important is that people really chant it, this kind of a mantra. And I personally use it all the time. When I'm sitting next to somebody that is dying, I'll often take my beads and I'll just say, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone far beyond, or just gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisvaha. And just repeat it again and again. And as you repeat that, what a mantra does is it actually begins to stabilize the mind. It begins to concentrate the mind and bring more into presence. Presence in this particular moment, at this time. And as Suzuki Roshi said, so this part of the Heart Sutra is really kind of magical. There's a magical quality to this. It's saying, in this world is where nirvana is. Can we be present enough? His phrase was, the world is its own magic. It's vague, it's unpredictable, it's not defined, and that's the way magic is supposed to be. And it's there even though we don't perceive it. The reality of the Heart Sutra, of things being the way they are, it doesn't require you to abide in it. It's just there. That's the way, the nature of reality. So I would encourage you all to practice the Heart Sutra. I'd encourage you to memorize it and chant it. Even you can just chant the first maybe paragraph, learn that. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, and practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, perceive that all skandhas are empty and was relieved of all suffering. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That which is form is emptiness, that which is emptiness form. Or just the end. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate. So that's the way most people use it, really, as a mantra, as a practice, as an encouragement. I asked Robin had a recording, I don't think I've heard this one, of people chanting gate, gate. And I thought maybe we could just end with that, how using it as a mantra practice, if we get it online. Yeah, go ahead. Is this chanted, you know, in Tibetan or general? Or
it's just the gate gate part.
Okay. So this is somebody's, you know, this isn't a traditional one that's chanted in a traditional, this is somebody's kind of interpretation of the gate gate part. So I haven't actually heard this, so let's see what it says.